podcast this week, I wonder who our guest is. Yes, it's Wanda Maximoff herself, aka Elizabeth Olsen, star of Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness. Plus, the usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast that likes to think there's a multiverse out there somewhere where it didn't once ask Sam Raimi if his success was, quote, beyond your wildest ken, which is a Scottish phrase we had seen in the Bruins and Uruwilly. And then we had to spend 3 minutes explaining what that meant to a rather confused director. It would be lovely if there was a multiverse where that hadn't happened.
It made you the man you are, Chris.
It did.
Yes, it did. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the Empire Podcast, which this week is being recorded virtually for a number of reasons. One, scheduling snafus up the wazoo. It's never good to have a snafu up the wazoo, but that's exactly what we had. So we're recording this now on Friday morning, the day the podcast goes out. So the movie news section is going to be the freshest it's ever been. Red hot movie news, folks, including the discussion of that thing that happened last week, just as we put the podcast up. But yes, this is Friday, 6th of May, 13 minutes past 8 in the morning. I'm here with my two colleagues of such lethal cunning. Geek Queen Helen O'Hara is here.
Hello.
Great big fucking nerd James Dyer is here.
Good morning. Is it morning? I'm so tired, I can't really tell.
Who knows? At least one of us, and I'm not going to say who, is naked from the waist down right now.
Well, I've seen James.
Steady.
And he walked away, like, as in he walked away from the mic at one point and came back. So at that point, at least, he wasn't naked from the waist down. I know
I removed my trousers when I sat back down, obviously.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's move on quickly, shall we? How are you both? I also have a cold, which is probably another reason why we're doing this. Not in the studio, but remotely today. But it's not COVID, I have been told repeatedly by the LFT.
I also have a cold. I probably shouldn't have licked you all those times last week, I guess. I'm sorry. But yes, also been told it's not COVID. So, hey, I mean, I guess nature is healing if we're just getting colds again. That's great.
I remember colds, vaguely. I don't have a cold. Sorry, I can't join this club. But I'm very, very tired because I got in late last night.
Helen, quick, lick James.
Yes, lick me through the screen. We had a Pilot TV event last night, which is very exciting for Bosch Legacy, the new Bosch series, which Titus Welliver came to. It was very exciting.
I hear it was a bit of a Bosch job.
It was in many ways because I was hosting it, but yes, it was all the lols.
See, Titus Welliver could have joined us. Yes, I know you had him on the Pilot TV podcast.
We did.
But
this,
you know,
yes.
he could have.
He's
yeah,
on
he
next show.
He's a big fan of Empire.
He is. He loves Empire. In fact, we talked about that quite a lot. He's also a big fan of everything that we love. Like, I feel like he's the long lost member of The Office that we never had.
But he's really fucking cool.
Yeah.
He's like, also cool. Yeah, that's the thing he has over us. Definitely.
That's the thing. If he spent even more than an hour in our company, oh God, he'd probably want to kill us all.
The cool might rub off, though, I like to think. Like, we'd be cool by association.
I think if we asked Titus Welliver to rub off on us, that's probably a violation.
As your lawyer, don't do that. Yeah.
But I mean, obviously, I told him his face is his warrant that gives him jurisdiction on this podcast anytime he wants. So
it does.
Yeah.
It does indeed.
Amazing.
Anytime at all. The open invitation to Titus Welliver. You can appear in the podcast whenever you want. Just click your fingers and we will start recording the podcast around you, sir. That is how this works. Titus Welliver, of course, he is on a TV show. So he's on Bosch, as you know, James has said ad infinitum on this show, and indeed the Pilot TV podcast. And that leads us nicely into this week's listener question, which is the listener question we delayed not just from last week, but the week before. And it is from
Kingy1885.
Genuinely don't have the question anymore because it's in my DMs and it's been buried under a ton of Doctor Strange questions that I haven't asked for, but thanks anyway. thank God I've seen the movie because there are spoilers up in my DMs right now. But the question is from a person whose name I will find and then dub in later on. And the question was, again, I don't have it to hand, but it was something about the best movie star cameo in a TV show. So what's the best movie star cameo in a TV show? And here I want to lay some ground rules down, first of all,
okay.
before we get into this.
Before I kick off. Yeah, okay.
So this has to be an actual cameo. Maybe not even just like a walk-on, but something where it has lines, maybe a bit of an arc, even. It has to be from an after-they-were-famous movie star. So it can't be from someone who just before they burst into superstardom. Mm. And we're only allowed one Friends and one Simpsons character each.
I would say, I know who my Friends one will be. No, I'm just trying to decide on Simpsons.
See, Simpsons, there's so many I can't. Mm. There's just too many. It sounds
too
like
many.
I'm trying to canvas over my lack of Simpsons knowledge. There's so many. There's just too many Simpsons characters. I just can't. I just can't think of who it is. But, you know, the best ones.
But, okay, and I'm going to be that guy. How we, like, so obviously we're saying, like, movie star cameos in TV shows. But, like, are we saying that that movie star cannot have done TV prior to them? Because obviously that just makes them a TV star.
No, of course not.
No, primarily known for. I think we know that we feel the difference, right? Like, we feel what they're primarily known for. Like, okay, there are going to be some grey area people, like maybe Kiefer Sutherland, who did 24 and sort of launched the whole movie stars on TV, you know, craze to an extent. Discuss 10 points. Anyway, but like, you know, when Brad Pitt turns up in Friends, which is my answer for Friends, that's a movie star cameo in a TV show.
It's a solid answer as well, because that is
It's a really funny bit. And I guess it's become slightly less funny since they divorced.
It's aged less well, yeah.
But when they were married and he turns up as the president of the I Hate Rachel Green Club, or the vice president, obviously Ross was president. Just brilliant. And his, you know, complex carbs and Rachel Green, my two greatest enemies. I mean, just, he was flawless. Absolutely flawless. Yeah. Loved it.
Yeah. Closely followed by Bruce Willis.
You see, and we'll see, Bruce Willis, James, technically is a TV star. Who?
No, only he was not.
Only kidding. But that is interesting because he comes full circle, doesn't he?
He does, yeah.
He was TV, then he was movie, then he was TV. And of course, and we're not the first people to raise this point, Joey and Chandler idolize Die Hard, and they don't seem to recognize that Elizabeth's dad looks exactly like Bruce Willis.
Yeah. So
chew on that.
So maybe Stallone did star in Die Hard in that universe.
I like to think it was Frank Sinatra. I like to think that he did take up the contractual obligation offer because he starred in The Detective, and they had to offer Die Hard to him, even though he was in his, what, 60s or 70s by the time Die Hard came around. So if he had done that again, because technically Die Hard is kind of a sequel to The Detective, kind of.
Kind of.
Not really, but kind of, in a multiversal kind of way. It would have been really fun to have a really old, bewigged, toupeed Frank Sinatra swanning around the Nakatomi Plaza, perhaps singing a song at Hans Gruber. That would have been fun.
He could have sung that song, "Do you like to swing on a star, carry moonbeams home?"
He could have sung, "Let us know, let us know, let us know, let us know, let us know." Yeah, he could have done that instead, which I'm sure he did, probably did.
Probably.
Anyway, we're getting off the beaten path.
Yes, we may be
already.
Slightly off
yes.
track. Okay.
So there we go. My favorite Friends cameo,
yes,
because there were some Friends cameos I just don't like. I think they're obviously there. Just the worst one is the Robin Williams Billy Crystal cameo, which I think might be in the first season, which they're in Central Perk and they basically get into a bit of a comedic argument that I never really found funny, even though I obviously worship that show. And they were basically on that just to promote Father's Day, in which they starred, and which was out at the same time, and which was made by the same studio, Warner Brothers. And I just felt like the worst kind of brand synergy.
Yeah.
But my favorite Friends cameo, love Reese Witherspoon.
She's great.
I love someone who can get in and have a little bit of an arc and, you know, get their teeth into a bit of a character. But it's Jeff Goldblum playing himself for me, you know, and all his kind of faux pretentious actor coach nonsense that he gives to Joey, and then of course that episode, because he's none more Goldblum in that moment, and then of course the episode ends with Joey pissing on him. So it's a really fun cameo, gold from Goldblum. Jimbo, do you have anything?
Oh, what's a pick
from Friends? From Friends
in particular. Oh God, yeah. I pure movie people. I think you've covered off my main go-to ones from Friends, but I want to pick up a different one with this, and I want to pick up Ben Kingsley in The Sopranos, which, because The Sopranos isn't a show that you would obviously associate with cameos, and it's not a show which you would even think would thematically work with cameos at all, and yet Ben Kingsley is on it playing himself, and it is A, hilarious, Sir Ben, and B, feels entirely organic, because Christopher's obviously wanting to get into the movie industry, and he ends up latching onto Ben Kingsley, who is just an absolute monster. And it's great. And again, like, I think this was publicized beforehand, as I recall. And I was a bit like, oh, Sopranos jumped the shark. This seems like a gimmick. I don't like it. And, you know, Chase pulls it off. It's great.
Yeah, that's a good one. Jon Favreau is in The Sopranos as himself as well, isn't he? At a certain point.
Yes.
He's, yeah. very, very briefly.
Yeah. Lauren Bacall's in that episode as well, actually, funnily enough.
Oh, my God. As herself?
I'm trying to remember. I think so. It's been such a long time since I've seen it.
Okay. Because obviously then there are categories. There's people playing themselves and there's people playing characters. And yep. So Mike Goldblum, he plays himself, but Brad Pitt plays someone else. Peter Bogdanovich, the great Peter Bogdanovich, had an actual recurring role on The Sopranos. So you can maybe,
very
can maybe
true.
Say that one.
Very yeah. true. Okay, speaking of things that are kind of, well, that brought me to mind, I want to say David Cronenberg in Star Trek Discovery, which I just...
Oh,
but,
yeah.
But that was a proper, like, have I slipped through the multiverse moment, because David Cronenberg is not just... He's got a proper role. He's a recurring character.
That's
on Star
wild.
Trek Discovery, and it's just... bonkers. And the thing is, I love the fact that they haven't attempted to make him look a bit Bajoran and a bit Cardassian. He just looks like the fucking David Cronenberg. They just said, we don't need Romulans, we don't need to be Borg, we just want you to be future David Cronenberg. And that's who he is. And it's amazing. And possibly the only good thing in the most recent series of Discovery. But that's not the end of that.
I mean, I'm trying to think through 30 Rock. But a lot of my favourite cameos in that are actually other TV people, like the Aaron Sorkin Walk and Talk, where he's up for the same job as Liz. which is amazing.
30 Rock has loads, but it's not my favourite one. But I love the fact that Michael Sheen, when Michael Sheen turns up in 30 Rock,
he
plays
Wesley
a character
Snipes.
Called Wesley Snipes, which is really fun. It's a really fun idea. And that brings me to one of my favourite movie star cameos in a TV show, which is... Wesley Snipes in What We Do in the Shadows, where he plays essentially Blade, but obviously for copyright reasons they can't call him Blade, so they just call him Wesley. So it's the first season episode where
it might be the finale,
and they're brought before the Vampire Council for judging because they've transgressed earlier in the season. And if you haven't seen What We Do in the Shadows, the TV show, by the way, is fucking hilarious.
It's amazing.
It's so good. And so we get a whole bunch of cameos here from people who have played vampires on the
That's
big
right.
screen.
Tilda Swinton from Only
Tilda
Lovers
Swinton.
Left Alive. Amazing.
Danny Trejo from Dusk Till Dawn. We have Evan Rachel Wood from...
True Blood.
There's tons of people. Obviously, Taika Waititi is there. Jemaine Clement is there. The other fella from What We Do in the Shadows, the movie, is also there. can't remember his name. Anyway, he's very good. And there's loads and loads of people. And then the pièce de résistance is that they have Blade / Wesley Snipes dialing in on Skype. And there's lots of connection issues. And it's very, very funny. And they reference tons of other people, like The Stat and... whatnot. The conceit is that they are all basically vampires in real life. So they're not playing their characters from these movies. They're playing themselves. So Tilda Swinton's a vampire. Danny Trejo is a vampire. Wesley Snipes is a vampire. A daywalking vampire. So that's really fun. Yeah. Wesley Snipes.
That's a very good answer. I also love the line in 30 Rock. Look at him, look at me. Which one do you think should be called Wesley Snipes? Amazing line. That is an absolutely terrific one. Depending on our definition of movie star, Prince in New Girl was pretty unexpected. Purple Rain.
Taylor Swift was in New Girl.
She was, but Prince is more of a movie star than Taylor Swift is.
I resent that. I've seen Cats.
I also have seen Cats. I
but was
my
she,
case.
Had she been in Cats before she was in New Girl?
No.
Well, therefore, that doesn't count.
Damn it. But she's Taylor Swift, so she's exempt from all caveats.
I love it. James is such a Taylor Swift stan. Is that how the kids say it these days?
I believe so.
Yeah, it's absolutely wild. that's a good one. Prince, okay, I guess I technically will allow it because of, yes, you're right, Purple Rain. But he's not really a movie star, but he's Prince. So therefore,
he's Prince. He's an everything star. Okay.
Michael J. Fox or Michael A. Fox, as is his real name.
Michael Andrew Fox.
Yeah. And I'm not going to go for the Curb Your Enthusiasm where he pays himself, mainly because I don't like Curb Your Enthusiasm. I'm going to go for his appearance in The Good Wife. Do you remember this?
Yes. Is that a cameo?
Canning. It's a recurring role.
It's a very, very good one.
It's a very good role. A very good role. He's an absolute monster. And it's glorious.
Oh my God, I've just remembered he's really good in Scrubs as well. He comes in for I think a couple of episodes in Scrubs as a kind of antagonist to JD, and that has triggered in me a memory of one of the great movie star cameos in a TV show. Prepare to have your hearts broken, folks.
Don't mention
it's Brendan Fraser. Brendan Fraser in Scrubs. That is one of the greatest episodes of the show. It is funny. It is tragic. Mm. He is sensational in it. Oh my God, Brendan Fraser in Scrubs.
For Ben. Oh my God.
I beg your pardon.
Isn't his character named Ben?
Oh no, okay. I thought you were breaking some horrible news to us there. Oh my God. Poor Ben Travis. Is this why he couldn't be here today? Because he's dead.
Oh God. It's got dark really fast.
So yes, Brendan Fraser in Scrubs. I've got a couple more. Shall I
bring
just,
it, please?
Shall I just list a couple?
Go on.
All right, keep going.
Oh, Jimbo, you go.
I wanna in the pre Cobra Kai years, I would have said the Ralph Macchio, William Zabka feud thing on How I Met Your Mother was pretty cool. The way, like, they're all hanging out with Ralph Macchio, and then he's in the costume, he's the clown, and it's William Zabka, and it's like, it feels like that episode almost feels like a setup for the whole of Cobra Kai. It's very, very funny.
Okay. I don't think I've seen that episode. That's one of those shows I kind of dip into and out of, and, you know.
I'm not a watcher of that show either, but I watched it for that.
Okay, I'm not a watcher of that show. I'm not a watcher.
All of Extras, obviously.
All of Extras, all of Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Ooh, Isabella Rossellini, that's a great Friends cameo. The Laminated List, which is amazing. And it's just when he shows her the list, she says, I'm not on the list. And he was just like, it's not the final draft. She goes, but it's laminated. It's just so mind-bogglingly awkward. And I think Schwimmer is at his best when Ross is super awkward, because he's always awkward. Yeah, love him.
Yeah, yeah. That is a great moment. Okay, so talk of Extras, because Extras is obviously a show built on movie star cameos. So I'm not going to mention any of those, although Patrick Stewart, it's too late. Yes. I've seen everything, is amazing. But that will lead me to one of my favorites, which is Big Liam, not on Derry Girls. I think we can probably talk about that now, because that jarred slightly for me. It was fun and everything.
Oh, you are a man without soul.
It pales into insignificance next to his cameo on Life's Too Short, in which he comes in as himself and has that amazing pitch to Ricky Gervais and Stephen Merchant, where he declares that he, the most intense man in the world, wants to do comedy. You know, that one, monologues, yes. Crazy characters, improvisation. And then he does a bunch of improv skits with Ricky Gervais, which all end with his characters having AIDS and dying.
Oh,
and it's the darkest thing, but it's absolutely amazing. So there you go, Big Liam.
Also, all the Star Trek ones. Can we just wipe over all the Star Trek ones? So The Rock on Star Trek Voyager, although he wasn't a movie star at the time. So many things. Robin, Ashley Judd on Next Generation. I mean, there are quite a lot of them, so I won't list them all.
Oh, there's so many.
A lot of those are pre-fame rather than
post-fame. I guess they're disqualified
A bit difficult.
The Cronenberg one's blown my mind.
You should watch it.
That's incredible.
Fucking wild.
I literally had to sort of stop for a second and wait, is that just a person who looks like it can't be, is it?
He's wearing the glasses.
I think he probably needs us to see Jimbo in first. You know, Cronenberg's not a first to a cameo. He's done loads of cameos and actually loads of supporting roles, and you know, he's literally the third lead in Nightbreed, for example, and he was in a Shudder TV show, a slasher TV show. I think it may even be called Slasher. He was in that, where he was actually in a whole bunch of episodes playing an actual role. And that came out last year.
Scorsese's been in some TV shows. I know he's done
movie cameos. There's a great episode of Curb where he plays himself.
Maybe that's what I'm thinking of.
Yeah. I wish he'd turned up in Friends. That would have been
amazing.
Maybe he'll turn up in season 2 of Moon Knight. We don't know.
Carrie Fisher was pretty good in Big Bang Theory.
Yes, she was. Also in Catastrophe.
Yes, very good.
Not a cameo, though.
Isn't that more playing a role?
Yeah. That's an actor playing a role.
The line between the two is a little fuzzy.
Hey, I rejected the whole premise of this question, so I'm just rolling with it as best I can.
And now you're loving it. Now you're loving it. You're like a pig in shit. But you know, speaking of actors playing roles, Ian McKellen starred in Coronation Street for about 10 episodes. And that was post Gandalf and post Magneto. And he basically went, I wish to star in Coronation Street. And they went, yeah, okay, fine. Go
whatever
ahead.
You like.
You're not going to argue with him, are you?
You want to play an armored bear? Street. Do it.
Yelling, you shall not pass in the Rover's Return. Whatever. So, yeah. And of course, where did Ben Kingsley get his start, folks?
In theater?
Coronation Street.
Jesus. In Coronation Street?
It seemed pretty obvious to me. Okay. That's where I was going. Okay.
Yeah, didn't follow the signs there.
No, sorry.
All right, okay. So just a couple of quick ones from me. And we haven't even mentioned Law & Order or Law & Order SVU or Law & Order Criminal Intent or Law & Order whatever the hell it is. Because Law & Order, SVU particularly, leans pretty heavily on movie star cameos, or did for a while. Proper movie stars doing proper movie star cameos, like Robin Williams and Sharon Stone, people like that. I remember seeing an episode of Law & Order where where both Idris Elba and Kerry Washington were in it, but kind of pre-fame. So I think it might have slightly predated The Wire, or, you know, even if it was maybe post-The Wire, it was at the point where he wasn't the huge star he is now. But Law & Order's got tons and tons and tons of them. I really liked Linny Manny in his cameo on Brooklyn Nine-Nine. I'm stretching the term movie star here a little bit. But
a little bit, maybe.
Because his presence elicits one of the great reaction shots from Melissa Fumero when she is told that her brother, who everyone thinks is perfect and, you know, and everyone idolizes him, but she's really, really jealous of him. And she's told that he's been arrested for cocaine possession. And her expression where she goes, oh, no, that's terrible. But she's
smiling
really
broadly.
Hard to she can contain the smile is just genius.
Also, great casting there, because Lin-Manuel Miranda as an overachiever in that family of overachievers, that's, you know, that's playing to his strengths, let's say.
Yes. Martin Short in Arrested Development, because he shows up as this 90-something-year-old man who has to be lifted by his personal valet, and it's one
amazing.
Of the funniest things. To the nuts!
He's also extremely good in The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt as a plastic surgeon. And he's got sort of, you know, terrifyingly taut skin, and they've got amazing prosthetics on him. And he's got a sort of not quite a fronk in Father of the Bride voice, but not far off.
Yeah.
And he's incredible in that. Absolutely incredible.
All right. Well, listen, that's a good note on which to end. You should always end these sections by talking about Martin Short. No, wait, Helen's got one more.
I did have one more, but it was another Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. Daniel Radcliffe in the sort of movie-length episode of Kimmy Schmidt, the Choose Your Own Adventure one.
I never saw that.
It's cute, and he's very funny in it. So, yeah.
All right. There you go. Daniel Radcliffe. Well, you should always end these sections talking about Daniel Radcliffe. That's what I say. So there we go. I had fun trolling down Cameo Lane. Jimbo, how did you feel about it?
I reject the premise of the question.
Why do you reject the premise of the question, Jim?
Because there is an innate snobbery in here saying that movie stars are slumming it on television and I'm having none of it because we live in an era of peak TV.
It isn't.
You
were looking for something that isn't there.
You're saying I'm manufacturing offense.
Yes.
A little bit.
Yes. Which would be so unlike you. Anyway, if you want to have your question read out on the Empire Podcast, you can get in touch with me via one method and one method only at the moment, which is bat signal. If you flash a bat signal in the sky, I will come running and then you can ask me the question in person under the bridge at midnight in the heart of Gotham. Or you can slide into my DMs on Twitter. I'm at Chris Hewitt. Or you can reply to any of my tweets or wait for a panicked shout out every now and again. But the DM strategy was what insert name here did a couple of weeks ago with that excellent question. Thank you so much indeed for that. Okay, so now it's time to talk about the movie news, the news of the movies, the things that have been happening in the world of movies over the last week or so. And as is tradition, pretty much the second I pressed upload on last week's podcast, two big old bits of movie news came squeaking out of the movie news butt.
Oh, no.
What?
Nobody wants to deal with that. No.
Anyway, one of them is that the Fantastic Four movie over at Marvel Studios no longer has a director because John Watts has left the project, citing basically exhaustion.
Exhaustion, yeah.
And he has made 3 Spider-Man movies in a very, very short space of time, and he wants to spend time with himself and some other projects, presumably. And he's stepping away with Marvel's blessing. That they're happy for him to do so. There is no suggestion that the powers of being have fallen out with him, unlike some other franchises I could name. Huh. So now we're looking for, well, no, I'll say we, but Kevin. If you're listening to this and you want my help finding a new director for Fantastic Four, then get in touch. But yes, they're looking for a new director for the Fantastic Four movie.
Well, I think any and all of us are free, right? So just FYI.
That would be catastrophically bad.
That would be absolutely the worst possible idea. Yes, yes.
I mean, three like giggling idiots who don't know what they're doing in charge of the Fantastic Four.
Monkeys in charge of the hen house. Yeah.
It might work in a sort of infinite monkeys kind of situation.
Well, I mean, there are only three of us, so just immediately it's flawed.
What would you do? How would we divide up the power on the set of Fantastic Four?
I'd be in charge of scripting, so the story whereby go to a dimension where they resurrect Thanos, I think that would be the direction we definitely want to go
that
in.
And then
they very quickly become the Fantastic Two when he clicks his fingers again.
The creative differences would rear their heads really early on that one, wouldn't they?
Helen, I think that you'd be good with actors.
Really?
Aww. Yeah, but she'd insist that Captain America was in every scene with a beard.
No.
And topless it's just, and greased up.
Absolutely, with nipples on display. And it's
again,
just like,
you're obsessed with nipples. I don't understand it, gentlemen.
I want the thing. I should finish a sentence. I want the thing in that movie to have Rocky nipples.
I don't think it's ever been done before.
Wow. Rocky nipples is my wrestling name.
Rocky nipples is my favorite Ben & Jerry's flavor.
So anyway, Fantastic Four doesn't have a director.
But I would take care of the visuals is what I'm saying.
Oh, you would. Oh, I see.
You would. Okay.
Yeah, Helen would take care of the acting. James fucking hell would take care of the scripting.
This seems like a spectacularly bad idea.
Oh, no, wait. You've got experience. I've got experience of a little bit of experience of acting. You've got experience with like visual effects dudes.
True. Yeah.
You know.
Visual effects dudes, that makes my social life sound a lot more
wrong.
Exciting than it is. Golly. I know some people in visual effects, yes, correct.
Yes, okay. And Jimbo has seen films with screenplays in them, so I think this will work.
So well, we have solved that. We don't have to worry anymore about who will direct.
But
Fantastic
say, for example,
Four.
Marvel don't do that. They don't take this silly left field choice and they choose us to direct the 23 to direct the Fantastic Four. Who would you choose? Who could step into John Watts' shoes? Presuming, of course, he's left his shoes behind.
Huh.
I mean, Justin Lin's free, so.
I mean, I've heard worse ideas. I've heard a lot worse ideas.
Honestly, there was a part of my mind whenever I saw this news that there was for a second the thought went through my head, did he get wind of this on the set of Fast 10, Justin Lin, and that maybe he's wanted to direct Fantastic Four forever, and that maybe is one of the reasons why he stepped away so he could put his hat into the ring for this.
I feel like he's much too professional to do that. But,
I think so.
But I love it as a conspiracy theory.
The thought flashed in and then flashed out again because obviously I don't think that's remotely close to what happened on Fast 10. There have been numerous reports in the week and lots of allegations that as we perhaps suspected, that he and Vin Diesel had a creative butting of the heads. Mm.
And there seems to be a situation where he thought he had a signed off script and the signed off script turned out not quite to be signed off, not just by Vin Diesel, but also by the studio. So it sounded like, and also there were issues, I think, with locations and everything
and
was
casting
becoming
and,
casting. Everything was becoming pretty hectic. So,
So
we like him. So he would not be a terrible choice for a Fantastic
He would not
Four.
Be a terrible choice.
Absolutely.
Louis Leterrier, who of course has experience in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, directed the, fourth best MCU movie in The Incredible Hulk, straight out the gate.
Which universe have we stumbled into? I'm confused.
Sorry, I forgot to say I'm a variant. Louis Leterrier has taken himself off the board because he is, I don't think it's been officially announced, but he's certainly in talks to replace Justin Lin as director of Fast X. So he's off the table. Let's say Justin Lin's off the table. What are you looking for from a director for Fantastic Four? You're looking for someone who can bring an earnestness to it? Someone who's got a bit of visual pizzazz?
Yeah. Can I make a confession?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I don't like the Fantastic Four.
Yeah, there you go.
I mean, that doesn't surprise anybody, James. It really doesn't.
I just don't. And I did read the comics when I was much younger, but there's a silliness to Fantastic Four, which I don't love. And look, I'm sure there are many people who know a lot more about comics, Titus Welliver included, who could tell me why I am so very, very wrong about Fantastic Four, and I'm willing to own that and accept it. But just in my experience of Fantastic Four, it's just like, again, like Bendy Stretcheroony, just like as our very own Dan Jolin used to call Mr. Fantastic. That's a shit power. I'm sorry. It's not just a shit power.
It's not a shit power. It can be very cool. I think done well, they can be brilliant. I'm not convinced they've
been
done.
Evidence to the contrary.
They haven't been done brilliantly so far. No, I mean, the 2015 film I thought was dreadful, but there might be something in what it was trying to do. I think there's something in the idea of these people being... No, but there's something in the idea of these people being particularly bound together by what they've been through, by having been through this transformative, very difficult experience and
shared
being bound
trauma.
and having, you know, their bond be as close as it is because of that. Like, that's a good idea from the 2015 one, or something you could kind of take from.
I just thought it was
a very bad, bad film, and their treatment of Sue Storm, I will not forgive. Anyway, but yeah, it could be done well. It could really be done well. And I think in the MCU, it could be fantastic.
I actually think that the two Tim Story films, although not very good, almost got close to the tone that the Fantastic Four should have for me.
And that's what worries me.
Jolly and upbeat, and there should be great interplay between these characters. In case you don't know who they are Reed Richards, Sue Storm, Johnny Storm, her brother, and Ben Grimm, who are four people who, you know, Reed Richards is the smartest man alive. He is an uber genius that makes Tony Stark look like me, and they are the first family of Marvel. They are basically the first creations, I believe, weren't they? They were the first ones out the gate.
First sort of super team anyway, I think, if I remember correctly. Yeah.
Which is, I think, why they are what they are. They're a product of their era. Hmm.
They're the first family of Marvel. They were one of the first, if not the first, creations out of the gate from the Stan Lee, Jack Kirby incredible wave of creativity that gripped that place in the early 60s in particular. And they fly into space and they get bombarded by cosmic rays. And those cosmic rays transform them, give them incredible powers, or what seemed like incredible powers in the early 1960s. And they turn Reed Richards into Mr. Fantastic, who is able to stretch his body in incredible, fantastic ways. Sue Storm becomes the Invisible Girl, now woman.
And that's a statement on the politics of the era, I think. But anyway, let's move on.
She can disappear at will.
She's also got kind of force fieldy type powers.
Yes. She can do all sorts of stuff now. And Johnny Storm becomes a Human Torch, so he's like super hot and off flame. Am I right? Mm. And Ben Grimm, one of the greatest characters in the MCU, becomes this kind of tortured, troubled soul called the Thing, because he transforms into this super strong, rocky creature.
Yeah,
and then. It basically kicks off the Hulk for 30 years.
The question, of course, has to be whether or not this film will pick up on the critical mythological conversation between Stan Lee and Jason Lee in Mallrats. And we will find out really the true nature of the Thing's thing.
Oh, no.
I have so many questions as well. Like Reed Richards, I mean, if you could stretch every part of your body. Anyway. That's all I'm saying. I don't know who the director is for this. I mean, Peyton Reed had a really strong pitch for the Fantastic Four years ago, where he wanted to set it in the 1960s. And we don't know how the Fantastic Four are going to be introduced into the MCU, whether they're going to be, you know, there's some sort of multiversal shenanigans where they're brought into our world from another world, or, you know, are they time travelers, or do they just...
turn up?
Do they just arrive? You know, because that's interesting, because they were the first in the Marvel Universe. And then could you port them into a world where they're maybe not quite as significant in terms of power or in terms of stature? But yeah, there's a lot of stuff. It's really interesting, tough nut to crack. Not least, how do you do Doctor Doom properly?
Yeah, well, not like 2015.
The Tim Story movies.
Or indeed the Tim Story movies.
You know, it is tantalizing. It's like, if you get it right, it is a really, really great property. Yeah. And I'm sad that John Watts has stepped away.
Yeah, but honestly, if he needs a break, I mean, I think we can all understand where he's coming from. So best of luck to him, and we're looking forward, I think, to see whatever he does next, whenever he does it.
Well, he's got this movie with George Clooney and Brad Pitt, which is a thriller that he's written that I think was always set up as the next project he would do post Spider-Man No Way Home. And then I think the expectation was that he would come back from that into Fantastic Four. But, you know, No Way Home, those three movies, he made those in 5 years. So, you know, that's an exhausting thing. So step away for a little bit. There was the article talking about this in the trades, said that the expectation is that he will come back and do more Spider-Man down the line. but they just don't know quite when that is. So I'm happy with that. If that's the outcome, great. The other thing that was announced last week, just as we pressed upload on the podcast, was the announcement of the title, not just for Mission Impossible 7, but for Mission Impossible 8 as well. And this was part of CinemaCon, where they showed the trailer for Mission Impossible, Dead Reckoning Part 1, which is now what Mission Impossible 7 is called. And Mission Impossible 8, well, you can guess.
What's it called?
Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Live Part Reckoning. 2.
No. Yeah, I'm not wild about the Part 1, Part 2, but that's just me.
Why not?
It bothers me. I know this is going to follow on, and I know it becomes a two-part story, but I don't know. No. I can't articulate it any better than that. I don't have anything other than a visceral dislike, because it makes me tired. The thought that I'm watching this and I'm like, oh, this is only half a film. Oh, I have to wait for the next one. That makes me tired. That's all I've got for you. I don't like it. Make it stop.
Okay. All right. It's interesting. What does it mean? What does the title Dead Reckoning mean?
Zombies.
Zombies, precisely.
100% zombies.
Yeah. Because Dead Reckoning actually was the original title for what became George A. Romero's Land of the Dead. It was Dead Reckoning for the longest time. The vehicle that they drive in that movie is Dead Reckoning. That's what it was named after. And there's a Humphrey Bogart film from the 40s called Dead Reckoning.
Well, I think it's all going to hark back to Mission Impossible 3, and the rabbit's foot is going to turn out to be literally the foot of a dead zombified rabbit, and that is going to be the cause of the outbreak.
Well, thank God they've got Simon Pegg on hand, because that dude has got
zombies.
Form.
He knows,
yeah. He knows how to battle zombies. I'm still excited about this. I think it's a very intriguing decision, strategical decision. The trailer I haven't seen, because we weren't at CinemaCon. I have been lucky enough to see something of Mission 7 whenever they showed Top Gun Maverick to journalists last year, and they had a little Mission 7 featurette beforehand, which had some jaw-dropping stuff in it. So, yeah, in McHugh and Cruise, we trust.
Absolutely.
Anyway, speaking of trailers, a trailer I haven't seen because they didn't show it before my screening of Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness, and I was unable to attend the rotating screening of it. It's on basically screening on a loop in London for a couple of days this week. Is the trailer for Avatar, The Way of Water.
Mm.
Jimbo and Helen, you've both seen the trailer.
At least.
Which still isn't online.
10
right?
times, I think we watched it pretty much, because I watched it that night that we went to the presentation, and then the next morning multiple times as well.
Oh, right. Yeah, and I saw it 4 times, and then once again in front of Doctor Strange, so quite a lot. It looks like an Avatar film, and it reminds you how gorgeous it is to go back to Pandora. I think that it's not entirely clear. Well, anything is not. It's not entirely clear at the moment. Like, it's very, very light, obviously, on story. It's got one line of dialogue in the entire trailer.
Yep.
It's much more about mood and feel and reminding you that these characters exist. It looks like there are a lot of new characters around Jake Sully and Neytiri, including, of course, their children, who I think are going to be a big part of this. I think there's going to be cute kids running around. People's opinion on that may rather vary.
Kill me now, be a man.
And we also see humanity once again, I think, coming for Pandora, and we see more militarized avatars coming.
Yes. So there is, as Alan says, not a lot happens in this trailer. It's not an action trailer. It is a mood trailer. There is one, and I'm not going to say it because I wait until people see the trailer. There is one very important plot point, which is not spoiled. It is deliberately divulged in this trailer. And it's a big one. It is a big one. So that's a bit of a wow moment. But I think for me, I am, to coin a phrase, profoundly in love with Pandora, and I think it's just stunning. And we talked about this last week, probably the week before, almost certainly the week before that. Like, Avatar was a fucking brilliant film, and this, you know, if you've forgotten why Avatar was brilliant, and let's be honest, it's easy to forget. Like, if a TV show goes away for 1 year, you forget all about it because there's so much shit happening. Avatar's like 13 years old, so everyone's forgotten about it. But I think this, watching this footage watching this first teaser like made me realize that this is event cinema. Like, this is proper market in your calendar, book your 3D IMAX ticket ahead of time and make sure you're fucking there cinema, because it's absolutely staggering. And the visuals in Avatar, you watch Avatar now, you watch it this evening, and I told you it was made this year, you would believe it, because it has aged brilliantly. But you watch this footage and it has advanced the detail in these characters 100-fold. Like, it looks so much better. And some of the stuff in this is breathtakingly beautiful. It
there's some water footage that is just drop-dead gorgeous.
Incredible. Absolutely incredible.
And I think, you know, it's Cameron's long-standing interest in the oceans, being married with his love of tech and Pandora as well. So I'm excited to see all of that. I feel like there's going to be a lot of new characters clearly to get our heads around.
Yeah.
And I find the avatars looked maybe less like their human actor counterparts this time than they did before to me. But again, that's on like seconds of footage, so it may become very, very clear when I watch it who's who. So yeah, I'm excited to see it. Just
and the 3D, it's worth mentioning. Like, we've talked about this before. Like, we all roll our eyes when we go into film and it's in 3D, because it's like, oh, fuck off. Like, it's just so tedious, because Avatar put 3D on the map properly because it was part of that immersive experience. And then everyone else just capitalized on the fact they could charge more for cinema tickets and did these sort of slightly shonky 3D conversions of things. But this looks like, it feels like something you want to see in 3D. You want to experience this in 3D as Cameron intended. And I just, yeah, I got sucked into it partly by that as well.
Yeah.
3D orchestrated by a director who knows what they're doing.
Hmm. Yeah.
Who pioneered the camera system used to create it.
Well, yeah, that's that too. But I mean, but that was always the way, like when, you know, when Spielberg and Scorsese made 3D films, they were markedly better than the average because they weren't into 3D exploitation in the same way that Cameron isn't. They're more about just giving depth and giving an extra literal dimension to
removing
the story.
Removing a barrier to the audience.
Yeah.
Another dimension, another dimension, another dimension, another dimension.
Rather than just having, you know, things fly at you out of the screen. So I'm super excited to see what he does.
There is a place for 3D movies in which things gratuitously fly at the screen.
You were talking to a fan of Journey to the Center of the Earth, which is nothing but things flying at you from the middle of the screen.
I'm just going to say it. Along those lines, Helen, never watch The Aristocrats in 3D. Just putting that out there.
Oh, God.
Why? Because it's a bunch of comedians telling a joke in 3D?
Yes. Yes, that's the reason. Not because things come flying out
of
the screen at you.
Have you seen The Aristocrats, James?
We've talked way too much about The Aristocrats lately.
We have, but it doesn't make it into the show because I always cut it out.
You always cut it out. You always cut it out. All of our Aristocrats riffs. And almost certainly for the best.
Probably was.
Almost certainly for the best. Occasionally, Gilbert Gottfried will show up in one of these recordings and go off in one for a little bit. And sometimes, maybe one day. Gilbert.
Every time you're like, this may be the week where Gilbert makes it into the final cut of the podcast.
I feel Gilbert might have to be in a live show. He has to be in a forum where he can't be cut out.
Yeah, this is not that week.
This is not that week. I'm not going to do it. Anyway, that's very exciting. I'm looking forward to seeing that. I'm going to see Doctor Strange again. So I will get the chance to wallow in the waters of Pandora with the trailer. Very excited about the film. Less excited about the kids.
Yeah, I know. There's a bit of a worry there. But I'm sure that, look, it's James Cameron. And his kids tend to be better than most. So
there was a kid in Aliens, for God's sake.
It was Newt, one of the great movie kids.
Yeah.
John Connor in Terminator 2, one of the great movie kids. So, yeah, in JC we trust.
There was also a trailer this week for Don't Worry, Darling. That's the new film from Olivia Wilde with Florence Pugh and Harry Styles. I'll be honest, I don't think it's spoilerific, but it might make you think it is. There's a lot going on in this trailer, but it gives you a real idea of the sense of cool and the sense of intrigue and mystery in this film, I think. I'm very hyped for this one. It's got a really good cast. Chris Pine is in there as well. Gemma Chan's in there. Olivia Wilde herself takes a role. I'm really intrigued to see what she does with this one because it's going to be very, very different from Booksmart.
I must confess, I stopped watching this trailer halfway through because I was like, nope, that is showing me too much of this movie. So it looks great, though. It looks really, really cool.
It looks really, really good.
But yeah, I'm avoiding the full trailer for this one. But Don't Worry, Darling looks very, very exciting indeed. Also exciting, my God, what a segue, is the news that the Quiet Place prequel that will be directed by Pig's Michael Sarnowski has now got a title And from the title,
pig.
We can...
A quiet pig.
A quiet pig. Nicolas Cage has to hunt for a pig, but really, really silently. And it's going to be called A Quiet Place, Day One. Mm. So it's a prequel, and it won't feature John Krasinski or Emily Blunt or any of the Abbott kids.
Well, I guess we saw their Day One in A Quiet Place Part Two.
It's a very risky proposition, this, because as ever, when you pull back the curtain this far with an origin story, you risk fucking up the entire saga, because people always say all prequels are fine, they don't affect, but they do, because you can't then watch the first one without having all this shit in your head. That's not to say it will be shit, but unless they make it properly good, the kind of emergence event, emergence day, it could be a misstep.
Yeah, but we've seen that kind of frenetic thing already, and people trying to figure out the rules as they go.
Yeah, like Bird Box, which I love and I am alone in. But
yes, I know. But you know, there's some stuff to play with here. I think it could be interesting at least. And if they do almost like real time kind of thing with it, I think, and put it in a very different location.
Yeah.
You could be on something. So,
well, my issue with Part Two was that it was basically a remake of Part One. It just felt like it hit a lot of the same notes. And this at least feels like it's trying something new. So that's
absolutely.
Yeah. Good. We've long said that this premise could withstand multiple treatments. You could have, you know, you could have a quiet place in a high-rise building. You could have a quiet place, you know, from the viewpoint of the government, and you know, they try and mobilize a response to this alien invasion. You could have a quiet place from the viewpoint of the scientists trying to figure out a way to combat it all. You could have all sorts of stuff. So I'm tentatively excited about this, I must say. Although it is one of those premises that when you begin to really dig into it, you go, okay. Because obviously they're formidable creatures, these alien creatures, but it wouldn't take more than a couple of days, I think, for them to cotton on to the frequency thing, surely. And it wouldn't take more than a couple of days for them to... Having said that, we've lived through 2 years of governments kind of keystone copsing the whole thing. So maybe they would fuck it up in the first 48 hours.
Almost certainly.
Just leave everyone to deal with it on their own. Anywho, that's exciting. Anything else?
John Woo is remaking The Killer with a peacock. So that's an unusual... No, that's not true. John Woo is remaking The Killer for Peacock, the streaming service. Obviously, John Woo has been looking to remake The Killer for quite a long time, but this is now moving ahead, and it's going to be on streaming service Peacock.
So when you say he's remaking The Killer with... As an American movie? American actors?
That's my understanding, yes. So he's been planning to do this... And it's gone through a few different iterations. I think Lupita Nyong'o was going to be starring it at one point. He was going to direct it. He's definitely attached to this Peacock version. Whether he's actually directing, I couldn't say for sure. I think he might be. More killer.
Less
filler.
Yeah. And there's the Obi-Wan trailer.
Yes.
Obi-Wan. Containing the sickest burn of the year, saying.
Which is
Uncle Owen saying, like you did his father.
Yes, I must train the boy. The boy must be trained. I must train him. Mr. Grimsdale. That's what he says. And then Owen, played once again by Joel Edgerton, goes, what, like you trained his dad?
Yeah, and then he pulls out a mic and drops it in the sand.
Yes. And listen, I theorized this on Twitter the other day, but I now have strong suspicions that Obi-Wan orchestrated the deaths of Uncle Owen and Aunt Beru as payback for that, because he was playing the long game. You know, how convenient it is that he wasn't there at the Lawrence homestead on the day that the Empire showed up.
Ben mentioned this in the office the other day. It is wild that Star Wars was a U for so many years when it has the charred and smoking corpses of Uncle Owen and Aunt Beru featuring quite prominently.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, listen, crispy fried Aunt Beru goes down well with a nice glass of cool, refreshing blue milk.
Oh, my God.
Would you a piece of char-grilled Uncle Owen, anybody?
It's like that and like Disney's Fox-based Robin Hood on the same BBFC rating. No wonder there's a generation of traumatized children.
But what do we think of the trailer in general?
Good. Made me excited. Obviously, there are a few John Williams-esque notes in there. It didn't have the previous teaser, and I said this at the time, leaned heavily on Duel of the Fates, and that did a lot of heavy lifting there, and you were like, oh, that looks so good. This doesn't have that, but it feels interesting, and obviously had a lot of the livery. We've got stormtroopers, we've got a bit of Vader action in there. It ticks all the right boxes. It gets you in the warm and fuzzies. like, so I'm excited about it. It got me psyched, but in the back of my head, like, my alarm is going off. My spidey sense is tingling that, again, like, you risk fracturing the multiverse when you play in this sandpit. Like, if you fuck about too much in the origin space, you risk breaking your toys. And that's always my concern.
Mm. I do have slight quibbles with the Vader-ness. I think it's where most of my concern is coming from. I mean, there is a blank slate as far as Kenobi himself is concerned, and there is probably space to play there. And the idea that they have that, you know, Jedi hunters are still going around and, you know, trying to find all the remaining Jedi solid, we've been there before, but solid, you know, basis for a Star Wars show. But the once you start bringing Vader into it, I feel like you start risking stepping onto the main timeline too much and mm-hmm. just messing things up. And especially when they've got Hayden Christensen in there. So what, we're going to see him potentially? Like, I'm not sure of the value of that. But
so we either see him with his helmet off, which defaders him a little bit, mm-hmm. or we see flashbacks. But
maybe flashbacks, yeah. I guess. But then, you know, I don't know.
If he doesn't have Sebastian Shaw's eyebrows, I riot.
That's the hill you're going to die on?
Yeah, okay. 100%.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah, I'm slightly worried about the Vader-iness of it as well, because I think they might lean into the fan service-y side of Vader, the same way they did with Rogue One, just to show how ultimately badass Vader is. Look at him taking out a bunch of dudes in a way that he never did in the other movies. And I do have a slight worry about that. Also, if they are going to confront each other, which it seems certain that they are, it can't be on Tatooine, right? It can't be on Tatooine.
It makes no sense at all, yeah. Because he continues to live there. So.
Yes, under the same name.
Yeah, I'm going to change my name to Ben.
Yes,
hang on a minute.
No one suspects Ben.
Ben, is it Obi-Wan Travis? Who knows?
Obi-Wan Travis. That's a name I've not heard in a long time. Anyway, it looks great. You know, and we do get to see other worlds and other characters. We've got to see Kumail Nanjiani for the first time in this trailer, so... and we still don't really know what the plot is.
Nothing.
And, you know, listen, Joel Edgerton, since he last played Owen Lars in the prequels, has become a fantastic actor. He's become a bit of a movie star in his own right, and he has become a great director in his own right. So there must be something in this material to get Ewan back, to get him back, and to get some really great people in the cast. So excited. I'm excited about it. The trailer made me feel good Star Wars feels, and that's after the Book of Boba Fett, that is a good place to be. Right, James talked about fracturing the multiverse, and I think that is a nice way to introduce this week's guest.
Hurrah.
Hooray! Good old James with his lovely segues. Because our guest this week is Elizabeth Olsen, who plays Wanda Maximoff, a.k.a. the Scarlet Witch, in Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness. All very, very exciting. It is not just a sequel to Doctor Strange or Avengers Infinity War or Endgame or any of those other movies. It is also a sequel to WandaVision, last year's excellent MCU show, which is on Disney+. And so Elizabeth Olsen, who has been playing Wanda now since 2014, when she first pops up at the end of Captain America, The Winter Soldier, was in London last week to promote the movie, and I had a good old chat with her over Zoom. Yes, she was in London, I was in London, and yet we did this on Zoom. That's just one of the many bizarre things about this interview, because I hadn't seen the film, they hadn't shown me the film ahead of this interview, she hadn't seen the film ahead of this interview, so we had to kind of talk around that. We couldn't really talk about Wanda or what she does in the film, because I'd seen 20 minutes of Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness, but she was only in about 90 seconds of those 20 minutes. So we had a somewhat limited window of Multiverse of Madness chat. So instead we talk about other things, her love of London and how she has shaped and developed this character over the last decade or so. I always have a lot of fun talking to Elizabeth Olsen, and I hope you guys will have a lot of fun listening to it. Here we go. Do please enjoy. We are delighted to be joined on the Empire Podcast by the star of Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness, Elizabeth Olsen. How the devil are you?
I'm doing great. I'm always very happy to be in London or England generally.
Do you get a chance to get out? Because, you know, I imagine you do. You were here shooting the film for about 6 months, weren't you? So.
Oh, yes. But I was able to enjoy the beautiful weekend that that London had, this sunny weather. So. But yes, I wasn't filming in Richmond. I was living in Richmond. We were filming Doctor Strange. And I mean, I'm so close to trying to get an alien visa, I have to say. I love it here very much. I think I'm joking, and I'm not.
No, I'm not at all. So what's your London haunt? Don't tell me everywhere you go, but what's your London tip? What if someone was coming here and you had a tip for a tourist, where would you go? Where would Elizabeth Olsen say that you should go?
I just love the Heath so much.
Okay.
And so I know that's, but I also just like walking around aimlessly. I walk everywhere when I'm here. People thought when I was living here, when we were filming Ultron, I would walk the canals from Primrose, get off in Angel, and then like walk the streets and walk all the way to Shoreditch. I just like covered London by foot all the time.
Wow.
And then I would do it the other way. To the west side. And so I just love being here so much. I feel safe here. Even though it's also like wild, but I do feel very safe in this city. So I just love being here.
That's amazing.
And the parks, like every city needs to have beautiful parks, and the parks here are unbelievable.
Yeah, I live in Greenwich, so I live right by one of the most amazing parks in the city. Mm. It's extraordinary. But it sounds to me like, are you aware of the, I know this is a strange tangent, but go with me. Are you aware of what London cab drivers have to do in order to get their license? It's called the knowledge.
I'm aware of only a little bit from the docuseries Seven Up.
Yes.
What is it called?
Yeah, the Michael Apted series, one where it follows people every 7 years.
Yes, and one of the characters was getting his black cab license. And so I just remember the amount of work that he was doing in that documentary, but that's really it. Why?
I was just going to say, because it sounds to me like you could apply for this. Your knowledge of London, you've walked the streets, you know it intimately. It's back alleys, it's corners, it's dark corners.
I wish I remembered it better, sadly. I feel like that was like eight. How long ago did we film Ultron, maybe 8 years ago or something? Richmond, I know very well now.
Okay.
Because that was just last year.
That's true. Yeah. God, I was on set of Age of Ultron 2014. So were you, obviously.
Okay.
Which is wild. I mean, when you first came on board, and finally we could talk about Wanda now. When you first came on board, did you know? I mean, because when you're signing on to the MCU, even back then, you figure that you're going to be in for the long haul. But here we are, 8-9 years after you first signed on to that little cameo at the end of Captain America, the Winter Soldier. And now here you are, you're still playing Wanda in all her complexity and the way she's developed. That must be a surprise to you still.
Such a surprise. I mean, I also didn't sign up for a big contract with Marvel.
Okay.
So I continue to be surprised every time they use me. I didn't, because I wasn't like a title character. So you don't do that same contract of multiple movies. You only do like a little bit at a time. And so I actually wasn't put in that situation. So it's even more surprising that when Kevin asked me to do WandaVision, it was so terrifying because I got very comfortable taking up my little space, my little lane in these ensemble films. The pressure of leading one it only hit me when we were doing press for it, not when we were making it. It definitely feels different than how I started out.
Oh, that's interesting. So you didn't sign on to that big, you know, because Sam Jackson, when he signed on, it was 9 movies and Ruffalo's, you know, 9 movies. Wasn't anything like that?
No, nothing like that.
Have you been doing the last couple for free?
Yes. Yeah, I was just like, yeah, exactly. It's kind of like, we don't need a contract. We'll just, yeah. I'm just happy to be here.
I trust you guys. It's all good. It's
in kind good of, faith.
It's a buy one, get one free situation. That's mm-hmm. It's one of those. So that means then that you could, you know, obviously you have the power to say no, but
yes,
there's a reason WandaVision is a huge opportunity. Was this in a way, because I've spoken to Sam Raimi, I spoke to Jack Schaefer about WandaVision, and I know these movies were conceived and WandaVision were conceived relatively speaking at the same time. There's a lot of back and forth about what Wanda is doing. So was this in a way presented to you at the same time? Let's do WandaVision and then you will barrel straight into this.
Yes, but they didn't know what Doctor Strange would be. They knew what WandaVision would be. So I didn't know what Doctor Strange. We had the 6 months break when we were filming WandaVision because of the pandemic.
Yeah.
And it was a couple weeks before I went back to finishing WandaVision during the pandemic.
Okay.
That I was verbally explained the Doctor Strange plot. So I was like, oh, wow, I would have loved this information before we did WandaVision. But they kind of, that is the thing. Like when people think that, you know, our mouths are sealed with, our lips are sealed with, you know, not wanting to expose the future. We don't know the future. There's like truly nothing I could share because I find out 2 weeks or a month before I shoot the thing. So,
wow. Wow. Yeah. And has it changed? Because I got the feeling, I spoke to Michael Waldron and Sam about this movie, and, you know, it's changed a lot since its original inception with Scott Derrickson a few years ago. Did the movie as it is now, which I have to say for people listening at home, this will be out confusingly after the movie is out, but I haven't seen the movie yet. So it's one of those, but the movie as it is now, is it substantially different from what you were pitched at that time, or is it relatively the same?
No, I never knew the earlier iterations of this story. So when even people would like talk to me on set as, you know, explaining, oh, well, you know how it was before. I didn't know anything until it's more or less this story. I still don't really know what it was before. They've tried to explain it to me and it goes way over my head.
It's like, don't worry about that. That's fine. That's in the past. That is not happening. That's in the multiverse. That's all good. But with this, and again, I haven't seen the movie yet, but with
and
this,
me neither, by the way.
Have you not?
No, I haven't even seen the 20 minutes that they shared.
See, I've seen the 20 minutes.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. You turn up and then it stopped. And so I saw the scene with you and Benedict and you're clipping the trees.
Yes.
It's all very lovely. And then we don't really know where Wanda goes with that. But
sure.
My understanding from talking to people, and obviously this is a multiverse and it involves variants and whatnot, that this offers you and Benedict, both Benedicts and Chiwetel and pretty much everybody in the cast, a chance to play, shall we say, different versions of these characters you've been playing for so long. And that must be really fun, a really interesting, unique opportunity to put a different spin on characters.
Well, you're getting into territory that starts to scare me because you're actually talking about the film. So I will just kind of pivot and say, I think it's really exciting that we just that the multiverse exists, because how often are we in the space of, or I wonder what would have been had I made a different decision or a different choice.
Yes.
And so I do think there's this kind of endless opportunity that Marvel has created by opening up the multiverse. And so that's very fun to me as an actor as well.
Beautifully done. I have to say, the best scenario like this where we're talking about something we can't talk about that I've ever had is when I interviewed Henry Cavill for the Justice League movie.
Sure.
And, he couldn't say that he was in the movie. And so we were speaking for 20 minutes and I knew he was in the film. He knew he was in the film, but we couldn't say he was in the film. So
what were you guys pretending you were talking about?
I think video games, largely, pretty much.
See, you and I couldn't talk about that. I don't do those.
See, nor do I. So I was bluffing.
Oh, amazing.
I was really bluffing for Britain, I have to say.
Oh, wow.
So you're not a gamer, Lynn.
No, I'm not a gamer.
All right. Okay.
I played the games when I was in my youth. but I'm not a gamer.
Okay.
I hardly have television on, and if it's not dark out, there's no film or TV on. Music only or silence.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Until dark.
That what happens after dark?
What happens after dark is a big decision has to be made about what will be on the television. And it's mostly a sporting event.
Okay. I gotcha.
I love my sports. And that's the exception for the day rule as well. is if it is a sporting event that needs to be watched, like the Dodgers.
Okay. So we're talking American sports here. You haven't picked up a love of British sports from your time spent over here?
Not really, but I do enjoy a football game. But I don't have loyalty to a team that I'm rooting for, and I don't know the players. I'll know like Messi or whatever. and that's all I've got.
That's fine. That's a good place to start. That is a good place to start. Well, let's talk about something that I think we can talk about.
Sure.
Which is your past as Wanda. And what it is, what it's like for you in a way, being the constant throughout all these different iterations, throughout Age of Ultron and the movies you made with the Russo brothers, and then Jack Schaefer and Matt Shackman on WandaVision, and now here with Sam Raimi on this movie. The constant is you. Mm-hmm. So how involved have you been over the years in shaping Wanda and where she goes? Because she's such an intriguing character.
I wasn't that involved until really involved in the sense where they would ask me, do you have any ideas about where you'd want to go next? Like that is how I was involved in the earlier films. And mostly I was just like happy to be there. So I didn't really have too many things I was pitching. I was just very happy to be there and to always have something to play. I never felt like I didn't have an arc to play. So I was just grateful that I was one of the characters who got that. Or who did something that affected the film, which, not that doesn't have to be the case all the time. And it was for me. And I was very grateful for that. With WandaVision, it was definitely Jack wanting to work with me on what, she wanted to pick my brain, but the truth was, is she had already knew everything. She already understood everything that was played. Paul and I would create these little moments in between the films where we had assumed something happened, or I would create some sort of backstory in my mind from her childhood that led to where she was. And Jack felt that, saw that. I don't know how she intuited it. And then she put it in WandaVision, all these little moments that that we stitched together. And then also she invented some really big things that shifted, like the Darkhold, and that this idea that Wanda is actually a mythic person and has a destiny that it was set out for her, and that she presents to her at the end of WandaVision.
Yes.
And so I really that's like a whole new journey now that we get to have with the character, and I was so grateful that she could also interpret all this from the past and then present an amazing opportunity forward.
I mean, yeah, absolutely. Speaking of amazing opportunities, because it was, a chance for you to stretch in multiple ways, shooting in front of a live studio audience and approaching certain episodes with a very, very sitcom-y vibe.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's this really, really deep and complex exploration of mental health and grief and loss, and I guess we can get into spoiler territory for WandaVision a little bit.
Yeah, but the last
conversation that you had with Paul that Wanda has with Vision, I thought was absolutely heartbreaking. And getting the chance to play all that sort of stuff must be really fun for you.
It was a playground. It really was, that show. I like my whole body like woke up to have to play all the different tones and styles and this different genres, or I guess mostly sitcom, but the different versions of the sitcoms through the years. And then to also have something grounded, it truly was a gift of a job. And we also had so much fun making it. And that doesn't usually, there's this kind of theory that the hard ones are the ones that do well, or the ones that end up being successful. The ones that are really painful to make. And this was like truly joyful and had a kind of a shocking response for us all. And it was an amazing opportunity. And I really feel like it revitalized something in my own opportunities outside of Marvel. So there are many levels of me having a lot of gratitude for that show and for being a part of this, MCU.
Absolutely. And so what is next for you? I know you've just finished filming Love and Death.
I did. I just finished filming Love and Death, which was hard and amazing. And I am so excited for the world to see it in fall. And I can't wait to see. We had such an incredible cast and crew, and it's a character that I just adored. And so that's really kind of it. For acting, I'm going to do something with a friend in fall, and maybe, like, I don't know, I'm going to take some time off this summer.
All right. Well, listen, if I can suggest something, the Elizabeth Olsen London walking tour would be a great sideline.
Yeah. Thank you.
You just take it's people
a doc series.
Yeah. Well, precisely. That's it. Take this to National Geographic. You'll be absolutely fine. So you start off, you've got no Disney. Idea where you're going. Disney. Of course, Disney. There you go. This is brand synergy in full effect. I love it. And I just want to ask real quick, because I've got to let you go, about how far you've come in a way from that shot where we first see you in Winter Soldier, where you're doing the playing with the box thing.
Yeah.
How much did you have a handle on who Wanda was for that? Because that was presumably just one day.
I mean, it's seriously Joss's creation. I mean, she really was from his mind. He had the idea of how she physically moved that was interpreted through a choreographer and me. And I think he created something that was unique to the MCU at that time and was a character that he, you know, had on the page with the comics, but he didn't want to create the version of the comics. He wanted to create something that was adjacent. And somehow since then, we've gotten closer to the comics.
Yes.
And so it's been kind of this amazing journey, but there's, and since he kind of gave it to me with Ultron, I just took it with me for the ride, I feel. But I do feel like I feel very protective over Wanda. And it's also kind of amazing that she's not a character that we've seen in any other live action of these superheroes. So it feels very personal.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's wild, isn't it? Just that one day on set doing those hand gestures, and that locks you into decisions you make 7-8 years down the line. It's fascinating.
And I mean, yeah, it locked us into WandaVision just in that one moment where she sees the light.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, that was connected directly to that cameo. So it was amazing to bring that back as well.
Well, I've got to let you go. Elizabeth Olsen, it's a pleasure talking to you as always. I look forward to the Walking Tour documentary.
Thank you.
And Love and Death as well. Thanks very much. Take care. Okay, so that was Elizabeth Olsen, and we will be talking about Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness in just a few minutes, because there's only one place to start this week's reviews section, and that is with the movie that has the opposition running scared. That's why there's only really two movies to talk about this week. Not a lot out there in the old multiplex or silverplex, but let's talk about The Contractor, the Chris Pine action movie, which stars Chris Pine as the contractor.
Yes. He has to build a garage extension for someone. He's brought in at the last moment when there's no one else available because of the pandemic.
Yep.
And he has to knock down a structure, put in the foundations, and build it. And he does a great job. That's a spoiler.
Wow. That's that sounds fascinating.
It's an audacious movie in which you have to wait in real time for the 2 weeks it takes to get the parts.
Yes. It is, this is Tariq Saleh's film, and it stars Chris Pine as James Harper, and he is a soldier, and he is discharged from the services for an addiction to painkillers, or rather use of painkillers, not necessarily an
addiction.
It was a steroid, just for a knee injury that he has. And as I think many people do when they leave the army, he is adrift, he doesn't know what to do, and he gets sucked into the world of private military contractors, and is offered a rather large payday to help his family, which is struggling with debt, if he goes and does something which doesn't seem particularly bad or tricky or problematic. But as you can well imagine, it all goes foobar very, very quickly. His wife in this, played by Community's Gillian Jacobs, also has Ben Foster in it as well. Kiefer Sutherland turns up as well as his sort of like new CO for this sort of PMC. What struck me about this film is it is in no hurry to go anyway. So literally half an hour elapses before the film starts. And I don't mean the credits, like that would be ridiculous, but genuinely.
Kyle Fresh did that recently, in fairness.
It's true. But it just, it ticks along. He loses his job. He ambles about. He chats with his family. And you're thinking, there is going to be contracting in your contractor film, right? Like, yeah. And he finally gets there. And then it seems to be quite... It seems to latch onto this idea that PMCs are bad, as if this is something that no one has ever considered before. Like, and it's like, sure, this was never going to end well. And he goes into it, it all goes wrong. And then we get into a kind of like a man on the run, sort of Bourne-esque scenario. And that's quite fun. Like, once it kicked into gear, I'd say about 45 minute mark, I actually got quite into this. There's some fun action sequences, some surprises, some twists and turns. He's on the run. Like, who can he trust? Can he trust anyone? And I liked that. I think the only thing is it's very, very dour. Like, it takes itself extremely seriously, and I think you can have that if you frame the whole film that way, but it also has sort of, for want of a better word, silly action sequences that they want a bit of spectacle and excitement, and it doesn't really fit with the tone of the film. And ultimately, you know, it doesn't have what I would call a particularly profound message to it, and I feel it also peters out a little bit towards the end. I did enjoy this. I didn't think it was bad at all, but I don't think it really does anything new.
That was my big takeaway as well. It wanted to be a, you know, personal focus character study of this guy, you know, leaving the military, having gone to extraordinary lengths to try and stay in it, feeling a bit hard done by, but still wanting to do something on behalf of his country out of patriotism, and then being forced to question maybe some of those choices as a result of this new job. But it also wanted to have lots of men running through the streets with guns shooting at each other. And it's like, they didn't particularly sit very well. And if you think about, you know, like especially the Paul Greengrass Bourne films that did that very, very well, this, I don't think, manages to get that blend of action and sort of character work right. So it goes from too dour to too action-y and doesn't quite nail the switch in tone for me. I mean, good performances, of course. You know, Chris Pine is never bad. It's just, yeah, it just feels like a lesser version of films we've seen done better.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd say if you're looking for a Chris Pine, Ben Foster movie, go see Hell or High Water instead.
Absolutely.
It's fine, but it felt to me a little bit, it's not as glossy or as straight up action exploitation as say Without Remorse was last year, but both those movies feel a little bit like they're trying to be throwbacks to an earlier era of action movie, and they both miss the target in different ways by a fair amount, I would say. It's, you know, and when the action does kick in, it's decent, it's well staged. But I don't think it ever really reconciles its two halves. Make up your mind what you want to be in essence. Do you want to be an in-depth character study, or do you want to be a balls-to-the-wall action movie? And never really quite gets either part right. But, it's fine. Mm. It's fine. It's, you know, have an enjoyable couple of hours. It's on Prime Videos. So you can sit back in your Sofaplex and just have a decent time with a well-acted, well-staged Chris Pine movie. But it's not quite as good as it could be. It was originally called, by the way, Violence of Action. Which is possibly the worst title I've ever heard for a movie.
That's a very word salad kind of title.
Yeah. That's like one of those dreadful straight-to-video things that, you know, the likes of Bruce Willis or Frank Grillo would turn up in.
It's just like, let's put together nouns with conjunctions, and that's all we need. This film actually suffered a little bit for me that I watched this just before watching another film, which we all saw yesterday, which you can't really talk about, which knows what it is.
Yes.
It plays in this same arena, but it very much knows what it is, and it has no sort of weird identity crisis. So,
I know the movie you're talking about.
Yes, indeed.
Oh, that's exciting. Ooh. 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 So then, 3 stars then for the most 3-star movie in the history of 3 stars. It is 3 stars for The Contractor. Next up, it is the return of my beloved possessed goat boy, Sam Raimi, as the director. It's been too fucking long, quite frankly, since Sam Raimi directed a movie. 2013 with Oz, The Great and Powerful. And he took, well, he didn't mean to take some time off. A bunch of projects fell apart. He spent a year on a Warcraft movie, for example, and then that didn't go. But he is back, and he is back in the bosom of Marvel with Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness, which, of course, is a direct sequel to Doctor Strange, but also WandaVision and some other movies in there as well. Hell's Bells.
Yes, this film opens with a Doctor Strange on the run with a character who we soon learn is America Chavez, played by Xochitl Gomez. And she is someone who can jump between multiverses. She can travel between alternate dimensions. She comes into the MCU dimension, if you will. I was going to call it ours, but that would be confusing. And meets our Doctor Strange, who then has to figure out what to do with her, because she is essentially the walking, talking MacGuffin of this film. Everybody wants America's power to travel between the multiverse realities. And the question is how to protect her, how to save her, and how to stop very bad people from getting her power as the film goes on. So Strange has to reach out to Wong, of course, played by Benedict Wong. He has to reach out to Wanda, played by Elizabeth Olsen, and try whatever he can to keep this new girl safe. In the meantime, he's somewhat distracted by the wedding of his ex, Christine, Rachel McAdams. And then things go off in a big way. They go Maximoff. Yeah. Look, this is, I think this is quite a mid-tier Marvel movie, which is not an insult. Mid-tier Marvel is still better than many, many other franchises. But what we get is a lot of trans-dimensional travel. We get a lot of alternate versions of worlds and people who we may or may not already know. And we get a lot of quite deep dives into Marvel lore. Now, I think you can keep up with this if you've never seen anything, but it wouldn't be ideal. You want to have seen Doctor Strange. It would be nice if you've seen WandaVision. That would be nice to know where Wanda's coming from at the start of this film. You don't have to have done, but it would help. And of course, you know, the events of Endgame are referenced quite a bit. And it's interesting that they build in a little bit of kind of character work for Doctor Strange here, with people questioning whether his one plan that played out in Endgame was really the only way to defeat Thanos. And half the universe really have to die for 5 years? Seriously, was that the only plan you could come up with, dude? You know, so I thought that was kind of interesting, because I wasn't expecting him to have to reckon with much of that in this film, and he does. That said, it's not a film with an enormous amount of maybe character forward motion for him. It is much more of a chase movie. From about, I don't know, 20 minutes in, it's kind of banned on the run for the entire running time.
As the first movie was.
Yeah, I suppose so.
There's a moment where Doctor Strange, I think it's about halfway through with the first Doctor Strange, where it does become a real-time chase movie.
Yeah.
Which is not like the contractor where you're waiting for 2 weeks for Chris Pine to be delivered parts, but you know, from the attack on the different sanctorum, it becomes pretty frenetic. And this is, I guess, in the grand tradition of that one other movie.
It's funny you mentioned that, Helen, like the required reading to get into this, because they obviously made a big point when they launched Disney Plus, is nobody needs to watch these shows. It's been nice if you do, fine, it ties in, but don't need to watch them. And this, for me, is the first film where you're just like, don't you though? I think you might have to watch them a little bit, because I feel like you're right, you could enjoy this film without having seen WandaVision, but lots of it, you'd be just like, I don't know why this person is doing what they're doing just makes no sense to me. I feel like that show does a lot of heavy lifting to set this up. And, you know, without going into any spoilers, there's a reasonable amount of sort of like additional reading that enhances this film. There's additional material that you could go into. And so I cannot imagine, like, if this is someone out there wanders into a cinema and this is their first MCU movie, what would be going through their mind? I can't even imagine.
I feel like that's been the case for a while with a lot of the movies. I mean, obviously we've just had new characters in Shang-Chi and Eternals, and you could probably pick those up from zero. But with any sequel, you're going to be missing things, aren't you, if you haven't seen the original. So if you haven't seen the first Doctor Strange, yes, you're going to be at sea here a little bit. But I don't think it's absolutely essential. I think they have still walked that line where you can pick up what's going on, even if you haven't seen WandaVision. And there is a lot of fun here. I mean, there are Raimi touches at the very least. There is probably a little bit more gore maybe than we're used to in a Marvel movie. I mean, the the thing at the beginning with the eye and the tentacles, you know, that kind of stuff. There are
leans
some monsters
into the horror,
here.
Definitely.
Yeah, there are some monsters here who will certainly scare, you know, the more delicate among us and or small children. And there's a little bit of kind of there are some emotional stakes that I think will maybe test people as well. So it's not a cute, cuddly Marvel.
It's brutal at times. Yeah. Actually, I was quite shocked with how far they take it from a scares slash gore point of view. I mean, they've kind of touted this as Marvel's first horror movie, and I think there's a real fairness in that. And there are moments of these. I mean, it's not quite the charred and smoking corpses of Uncle Owen and Aunt Beru, but there are moments in this where I'm like, oh, you know, that's years of therapy ahead for some kids after that.
Interesting.
But it's, yeah. I mean, it's the thing with this, like, and I genuinely really like this. I thought it was great. I've often said that Doctor Strange is one of, if not the most underrated, the MCU movies, because I think it's fucking brilliant and I think he's amazing in it. And so I love this character. So I was very much in the tank for this from the get-go. I think things happen in this. A lot of things happen. All things, everything, everywhere, all at once in many ways. And so that the sort of velocity of this film and the amount of just crazy shit that it throws at you maybe papers over the fact that the character motivations and indeed depth isn't quite there in this film, I think. That said, it didn't ruin my enjoyment. I think there's tons of stuff going on. I think it is brilliant. I do think, weirdly, you know, having alluded to it, that the proximity of this release to Everything Everywhere All at Once, which is thematically similar in a number of ways, is an odd one. I watched these on subsequent nights. I watched this and then I watched Everything Everywhere the night afterwards. So it was quite a week for multiversing. And yeah, let's just say it's an interesting double bill.
Yeah, I'm not going to get into talking about that until next week. No, but
we'll talk about that next week. Yeah.
But I do think there's some really, really cool ideas here. There's some really fun bits of execution. I had a lot of fun with it. I saw it twice in one day. I still enjoyed it a second time around.
Yeah. the Predator's Gambit, as I call it.
but I wouldn't. You know, it's not going to trouble my Marvel top 10. It's somewhere in the teens, probably.
That's fair. But I often feel like to break the top 10 at this point is quite difficult. Like, you know, I think
you've
it's
got to get past like all the Cap movies. I mean, it's very
hey, come on, steady. steady now.
Yeah, no, I like this. I mean, it has polarized people and I completely understand why. And it is batshit insane from top to bottom. But I think that's part of its charm. And I do think shall we say, there are elements in this film that we obviously cannot talk about, which will polarize people. Some people will love it and some people will roll their eyes and hate it. And that's fine.
Hmm. How about you, Chris? I mean, was there enough Raimi in this for you?
Yeah, I've seen this being discussed an awful lot on, you know, about the authorship of this movie and, you know, would the Marvel machine allow enough Sam Raimi? Because you hire Sam Raimi, you want to get Sam Raimi, right? Otherwise, why are you hiring Sam Raimi? You could just hire another, you know.
Us, the three of us.
The 23. Hire the 23 to direct
Doctor
Strange.
You've got the Daniels, now you've got the 23.
Yes.
Good. I like this.
And, I have to say that, you know, I really... There are movies out there that bear the Sam Raimi stamp, perhaps more than this one does. You know, Evil Dead 2 and Evil Dead 1 and Army of Darkness and The Quick and the Dead and Darkman are pure Sam Raimi films. And here he is working a little bit within the framework, a little bit, but there are moments of pure Raimi. There's a sensational showdown between two characters towards the end of the film that it's one of the most visually and orally inventive things I've seen and heard in quite some time. There are moments where you're getting these little glimpses of it. You know, it feels a little bit like, now that's what I call Sam Raimi, at times, where the camera is roving. We don't quite get a bravura POV scene like the moment where the evil force chases Ash through the cabin in Evil Dead 2. But there are moments where he's definitely playing with, you know, some pretty bravura camera work, and stretching the frame again, the way he did in Evil Dead 2. There's some lovely transitions. He's, you know, he's a big one for really strange, pun unintended, transitions and montages. We get little glimpses of that in here. And although I would quibble with it being labeled a horror film, there are certainly, it's one of the darkest Marvel movies to date. if I were seeing this for the first time as like a 10-year-old or a 15-year-old, and this was one of my first quote unquote horror films, then it perhaps would be a gateway drug, because there are things in this. There are dark spirits and, you know, really fun things I can't really talk about.
Yeah, but there's something in the trailer. Like, so I don't think it's a spoiler to mention that. Okay. There's the scene with the sort of zombie strange.
Yes.
With the sort of ghost wings, like dark ghost wings.
Yes.
Which is stunning looking and horrific at the same time. And I thought that kind of thing visually, this film did really, really well.
You'd get every now and again a moment where you can see pure Sam Raimi, and we've been starved of Sam Raimi for so long that I will take all the Sam Raimi I can get, everything, everywhere, all at once, please. Yes, very, very much so. And, you know, I had a good time with the film. I think it has some issues that we will get into in the spoiler special, for sure. I think some of the character work doesn't quite impact for me. There's some of the emotional beats that the movie wants to hit. I don't think it quite gets there, but I have to say, this is on the first viewing. I have only seen it once at this point, so I'm going back to see it this weekend, and so perhaps I will lean into those a little bit more than I am doing so right now. But good performances across the board, some wonderful sequences, some really, really great action sequences as well, and some very, very intriguing stuff. This is a fucking difficult movie to talk about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I kind of don't want to go any... Like, I've barely gone 5 minutes into the plot, and I feel like... It's fun just to, I'm sure lots of you out there will have either figured out or seen way more spoilers than we're talking about. We're not going to add to that here because it is really fun to watch it play out in front of you.
Because this movie leaked, didn't it? And I luckily managed to avoid all the spoilers and all the leaks. Mm. But there are things in this movie that you would want to go in fresh.
Yeah, like knowing nothing would be ideal. Yeah. But you want to go in knowing nothing, but having watched everything else ever.
All at once.
Yeah. See, so that you understand it.
I don't know if you do. I don't know if you do. Because we're having this discussion a little bit with a couple of people on Twitter who are, you know, asking, what do I need to see beforehand? Because there was that nonsensical tweet from an idiot.
It's got to have been joking. I hope it was joking.
I think it was part... I think I can't honestly tell, because I looked at his feed and it was part of it. Part of his tweets made me think, this is a guy who's taking a piss, because he said, this is the greatest Marvel movie. No one will disagree when I say this is the greatest Marvel movie since Spider-Man No Way Home. So that's a joke, I guess. But then he might not be joking. I don't really know. Because there was a guy on Twitter this week who had seen the movie. Because I think a lot of people in the States saw it on Monday. We saw it on Tuesday. And he was like, you need to see, here's a list of the things you need to see before you see Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness. And it was nonsensical.
I mean, it included things like Deadpool 2, which I can tell you now.
Yeah. You really don't need to have seen that.
Like, I don't think that's a spoiler to say that Deadpool 2 is not relevant.
You can disregard 90% of the things on that list. And so there's a conversation that we're having with people on Twitter right now. What do you need to see before you see Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness, which is a title I love so much, I'm going to say it in full every single time. And I don't know that you need to see WandaVision.
I do.
I think it helps. Okay. It definitely helps. It's
a necessity. Like, it's not a necessity. In the same way that you could theoretically walk into Endgame having never watched an MCU film, I just wouldn't recommend it. I would say with this, if you are thinking of bringing someone who has not seen most and or all of this stuff, it's absolutely fine. There's still lots to enjoy here. I would think if you want to get the absolute most out of this film, obviously have watched all of the MCU movies to date would be a prerequisite for me. Watch WandaVision. If you've got the time and the inclination, maybe watch the What If episodes. I think you'll get a little bit of a bonus from having watched those, or even just for the flavor of this, if not for the substance. And then obviously there are other things, there are references in this to things that you may or may not have watched, but that's neither here nor there.
It's fine. Yeah. You don't have to get every deep cut reference if it's your first Marvel movie. There's still enough in there to have fun with.
There might be something. If you saw Endgame, you didn't see WandaVision, and you go into this, then there might be like, hang on, what's Wanda doing now? What's happened in the interim? What are they talking about? What's this Westview thing? But I think they do try and discuss that, and they fill people in as they go along. There's enough expository dialogue hurled at pace as people are hurtling at pace through the multiverse. There's enough there to think to take care of things. But what I mean is, I don't think you need to see WandaVision in the same way that when you're reading a comic book, you don't need to read every comic book. You don't need to read every Marvel comic book. This movie reminded me of that great tradition of, if you pick up a comic book, say you pick up Uncanny X-Men 373, and you're reading through it, and there's two characters having a conversation, and they go, that last time I just fought Spider-Man. And then there's an asterisk beside Spider-Man, and there's a little footnote panel at the bottom of the page with the asterisk going, as seen in Spectacular Spider-Man 74. Yeah. And so you don't have to have read Spectacular Spider-Man 74. And I know those comics don't cross over, don't worry. And hopefully, if they do, this is a sensationally lucky guess. But you don't have to have read those comics to get the full thing. But it's a nice little pointer. I could pick up Spectacular Spider-Man 74. I could watch WandaVision. And I think a lot of people will gravitate to WandaVision after seeing this movie. Mm. But anyway, that's it. Because of the presence of Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness, there isn't an awful lot else out this week, folks. So I think that's it. So 4 stars then for Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness. Do check it out. And yes, we will be doing at least one spoiler special on this movie over the coming weeks. So if you don't already subscribe to our spoiler special feeds, you've got lots of stuff awaiting you there. Nearly 250 spoiler specials, loads more to come over the next couple of months as we get into summer blockbuster season in particular. Oh my word, Top Gun Maverick and Jurassic World Dominion. It's going to be a very, very exciting summer season, folks. So do sign up. $2.99 a month or $32.99 a year. Go to supportingcast.fm/empire for details of how to do so, or indeed to do so. Anyway, on that note, that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun, where we'll be joined by, speaking of multiverses, the star of Everything Everywhere All at Once, the glorious return of the man who was Short Round in Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom and Data in the Goonies. It's been far too fucking long since this man acted in a movie. It's Ke-Hee Kwan. Very excited to have him on next week's episode. And there may be someone else knocking around as well. It's a multiverse. People could show up at any point. Anyway, until then, until we meet again, until that auspicious occasion, it is goodbye from my two colleagues of such lethal cunning. Squadcast names, the Wong Trousers,
James Dyer. Sling Ring Gromit or something.
Very good, very good.
That would be amazing. They should do that. They have the they have the money to do that. Someone's just making a train track for real.
I wanted them to go to a plasticine dimension. I really did. I've been robbed. Oh, maybe in the next Doctor Strange. Maybe
the
next
Aardman time. Dimension. Yeah.
Oh, my Aardman God. Dimension. That would be incredible.
I love that so much. It's not a dimension, is it? It's a multiverse, which is not to be confused with timeline. Oh,
it's all the same.
Very,
is it dimensions, multiverses, universes? It's all terminology.
I think we can use dimensions interchangeably,
yeah.
Actually. Yeah, technically.
Pay close attention. They'll take your brain to another dimension.
Okay.
Another dimension, another dimension, another dimension, another dimension. Anyway, it's goodbye from Melancholy and the Multiverse of Sadness.
Yes.
Helen O'Hara.
Toodaloo.
I like that a lot. I love your 90s references.
It's very laboured, but hey-ho.
It's great.
It's all good. And it's goodbye from me, Mr. Doctor in the Multiverse of Madness. I'm off now to ponder the eternal question, is there a multiverse in which Billy Corgan cracked a smile? Who knows? He's deep into wrestling now, Billy Corgan. Oh, did you know that?
I did not know that.
As a wrestler or just as a fan?
Billy Corgan. Billy Corgan. Billy Corgan, who is the singer-songwriter of the Smashing Pumpkins, is the owner and promoter of the NWA. That's an unfortunate acronym. It is, of course, the Neighborhood Watch Alliance. It's the National Wrestling Alliance, which is a kind of a rival to the WWE. Yeah. So he has launched this. He's a big-time wrestling aficionado.
Fair play to him.
Is Rocky Nipples one of his AAA performers?
We can only hope so.
Indeed. Okay, so in that case, the 23 are now off to try and cram Rocky Nipples into our Fantastic Four movie.
Oh boy.
Thank you so much for listening. See you next week. Bye.